From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, Jonathan Broder, Contributing Editor for Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator is Michael Williams, Contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. Despite the continuing baseless claims of widespread election fraud by U.S. President Donald Trump, an increasing number of elected officials in the United States and abroad recognized President-elect Joe Biden as the winner of the 2020 election and called for Trump to concede and cease actions that are both divisive and seemingly doomed to fail. President-elect Biden ramped up his transition, naming key staff to his economic and communications teams. The selections highlighted Biden's promise to create an administration of diversity and experience. COVID-19 continued to spike in the United States, and record travel during the recent national holiday has health officials concerned that a devastating wave of hospitalizations and fatalities may follow. Meanwhile, Great Britain became the first country to approve the use of a COVID-19 vaccine, with plans to distribute the vaccine before the end of the year, both with the most vulnerable groups receiving the vaccine as early as next week. And tensions between Israel and Iran heightened in the wake of the killing of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, Iran's top nuclear scientist, and the reported deaths of other high-level Iranian military and intelligence officials. Panelists, welcome. As we start with the 2020 election and the continued claims of fraud, I could say persistent and seemingly baseless claims of widespread voter fraud on the 2020 elections by President Donald Trump, a growing number of officials are, including officials in Trump's own Republican Party, are recognizing Joe Biden as the victor, and using the term president-elect, which seemed to be a very difficult thing to have happen, and called on Trump to cease and desist, as even as some officials are being threatened just for participating in elections, Trump so far has refused, insisting that the election was somehow rigged, even though he has lost virtually every legal appeal and has no proof of this election fraud. Linda, I'll start with you. Going forward, is there any factual basis to President Trump's continuing claims of election fraud?
There's no evidence as yet of widespread election fraud. So every election has irregularities. People vote twice. Dead people vote, and on and on. But what we're looking at here is allegations of widespread fraud. And even Attorney General William Barr came out this week and said there is no such evidence of widespread fraud, or at least so far as any investigations have unearthed. So at this point, this is just Donald Trump, frankly, trying to delay the inevitable and poison the well for the incoming president, Joe Biden.
Jonathan, the fraud that we have here, if we're talking about something that's meant to be as widespread as multi-state, maybe even a national election scheme that somehow would overturn millions of votes in just the right places while affecting President Trump, while not affecting those down ballot from him, because as everyone has commented, Senate Republicans and Republicans in the House of Representatives did surprisingly well during the election. My question is, who specifically is being named as responsible for this fraud? Has anyone in particular been named? Anyone in the Democratic Party, an official, an elected official, who's being blamed for this?
No one. There is no one person or group of people that are considered responsible. I mean, if Trump has anyone to blame, it would be probably Democratic election officials in the individual states. But there's one other thing that I think people need to realize about this. One of the reasons why Trump is continuing to hammer this issue is because he's raising money off of it. Now, the old expression, follow the money. He has raised so far $170 million, which has gone into a supposed election defense fund to purportedly fund continuing legal efforts to challenge the election results. The truth is that 75 to 80% of this money goes into a super PAC, which Trump can use not only for his personal travel, he can use it for anything.
And again, a super PAC being a election apparatus where money can be basically dumped into a bucket and used for any purpose that the organizer of that super PAC deems fit, as you say, anything from election costs to legal fees, you name it. Linda, going back to you, and you'd mentioned that William Barr declared the U.S. Justice Department has uncovered no evidence of widespread voter fraud that could have changed the outcome of the election. You have Wisconsin, Arizona, and Georgia all certifying their election results as fair and accurate, with, in some cases, Biden winning more votes after recounts were done. And yet, 70% of Republicans, by many polls, believe that there was widespread fraud and this election was somehow stolen from Donald Trump. How does the United States resolve that type of discrepancy in its own institutions between virtually one half of the country and another?
It's a huge challenge for President-elect Biden. He's going to need to work really hard to fulfill his promise to be the president of all Americans and not just those who voted for him. These polls that show that the majority of Republicans believe that basically Joe Biden stole the election, I take those very seriously. They represent a potentially toxic schism within American government and politics and American public life. But at the same time, I would caution against reading too much into that. I think at a time of high tension and drama in particular, people tend to think the worst of the candidate they don't support. So for example, when Barack Obama was president, people would be asked, do you think he's a Muslim? Do you think he was born in Kenya? Do you think he's a socialist? And people who opposed Obama all agreed to all of that, even if they might have known deep down it wasn't true. So I think for all these voters who believe that Donald Trump really did win a second term, I would just give them some time to process and relax and think about where we are going forward and how it might be possible to overcome this.
And it's worth noting that President Trump began essentially his serious political career, his current presidential aspirations, with the notion that Barack Obama was not an American somehow. The propagation of that lie began his serious candidacy within the Republican Party. So going back to you, and you'd mentioned election officials in the states where Trump is claiming that some of the manipulation took place. These people are facing a barrage of abuse and even death threats just for working on the election. These are not political people per se. They are involved in the political process of the election, but they're not political people. An election official in Georgia gave an impassioned plea to President Trump and to Republican senators to denounce the threats, saying, quote, those in positions of leadership need to display leadership. Linda alluded to this earlier. I want to ask you pretty much the same question. Are the baseless claims of fraud more or less harmless political posturing or a dangerous ruse that could really lead to tragic outcomes for individuals and for American democracy?
I think unfortunately, it's the second. I mean, we've seen during the campaign, before the election itself, there was a plot in Michigan by a local militia group, a right-wing militia group, to kidnap and possibly kill the governor of Michigan. I mean, this is extraordinary. Now, these people were uncovered and arrested, but you know, there are a lot of sort of what they call lone wolves, people who are not on anybody's radar. They're not a part of any white supremacist or militia group. They're just individuals who are inspired by racist ideology, and they all have weapons. This is going to be a problem. It already is a problem, but it's, I fear, going to be a bigger problem for law enforcement.
Well, I think the courts have not yielded any success for Donald Trump's claims. The court of public opinion seems to be turning gradually, and the clock is ticking. Let's move on to the Biden transition. President-elect Joe Biden has formally introduced this past week the officials who will lead his economic and also his communications team. He's poised to take the helm of the federal government as the nation is really grappling with the economic fallout of a health crisis, the coronavirus pandemic. And I will say first that we continually, I guess, covered the transition process, but I think it's important that we do so because of the nature of this transition, both the point in history that it is, and because it's been a transition like no other that I have seen in terms of the difficulty and the non-cooperation. So both the exterior and interior circumstances warrant us from keeping up with this thing. With that said, I'll go to you, Jonathan. Who are the key people on the economic team coming in? I would start with Janet Yellen. It's a name that may be familiar to our listeners, but talk a little bit about her and her importance to this team.
There's Janet Yellen, of course. She was the former chairman of the Federal Reserve. She's been nominated to be the next Treasury Secretary, very, very experienced economist, and someone who has sort of created a lot of confidence or optimism in the way that this administration is going to handle the economic situation that the country's in. There's also Neera Tanden, who is currently the head of a progressive or left, center-left think tank called the Center for American Progress. She's been chosen to be the to lead the Office of Management and Budget. And she is a bit controversial because many Republicans consider her a bit too partisan for the position. There is Cecilia Rouse to be the chair of the Council of Economic Advisers. I hope I pronounce this right. Adewale Adeyemo as Treasury Secretary. And then Jared Bernstein and Heather Boushey as members of the White House Council of Economic Advisers. Heather Boushey is another one who is controversial. Apparently, there are people at the think tank that she used to run who feel that she is not the greatest manager in the world. So some of these issues are probably going to, are very clearly going to play out during the confirmation hearings.
And before we go to break, and we'll continue this topic after, Linda, your comments on the team coming in, both the economic team and I'm especially interested in your comments on the communications team, as Joe Biden has chosen an all-female communications team for his administration.
What's been so striking about Joe Biden's appointment so far is the diversity. As you said, all women running the communications shop, both press secretary, deputy press secretary, communications director, all women. Some are women of color. Some are LGBT. We're also seeing, I think, interestingly, some tension over pressure that Joe Biden faces to appoint people of color to high-profile positions. So he may be on the verge of nominating the first female defense secretary, but others are arguing that it needs to be a Black person. So there's some names being put forth in that regard. In the effort to be diverse, which is, of course, long overdue, nothing's ever completely harmonious and happy in that world.
Yeah, it's very hard to keep all the constituencies happy in either party. We know that for a fact. We'll take a quick break and come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. Jonathan Broder, Contributing Editor for Congressional Quarterly. And our moderator, Michael Williams, Contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. As we complete this discussion of the Biden transition, I just wanted to take a look at the criticism that has been leveled at some of the incoming people. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, a Republican senator, alluded to the fact that all of the, or many of the appointments by Joe Biden have been from an Ivy League background and that they were somehow the appeasers to the ideas of globalism, that sort of thing. Very early to take shots at a group that hasn't even faced its first hearing yet. When you hear this sort of criticism, Jonathan, do you feel like, again, it's legitimate concerns on their part or more posturing for upcoming hearings or even towards the 2024 election cycle? I can't even believe we don't even have an inauguration yet for 2020. We're talking about the 2024 election cycle. But is it part of that?
I think it's pure politics. These nominations are a chance for the Republicans. In this case, now they're the, at least in terms of presidential politics, they are the opposition. So they're going to start raising issues that they feel might play politically. So Marco Rubio mentions the elitist Ivy League background, these nominees. And that is, in a way, a way of energizing the Republican base of people who don't have an Ivy League education, or perhaps no college education at all. And we know that from analysis of polling that the people who have been the biggest supporters of the of Trump and of Republicans are white men without a college education. So you can see who Rubio is targeting when he makes a comment like that.
Yeah, it does seem to be purely political, especially since the resumes of the people who've been chosen so far are practically spotless. And the one I'd like to mention before we go forward is Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith. She's a healthcare expert from Yale University, and she's about to become the most famous doctor in the world as she's been chosen by Biden to lead his pandemic task force. Let's move on to the COVID-19 crisis. The world's largest COVID-19 outbreak, it seems like we're saying this weekly, is in the United States. The virus largely hit urban areas first in the U.S. early in the pandemic, but the current surge is now devastating rural America, which has far less resources to deal with the wave of cases and hospitalizations. New estimates are for 400,000 deaths or more before the end of the winter. And those estimates were prior to the Thanksgiving Day travel surge that created the kind of small family gathering that health officials now believe are the most common way the virus is transmitted. Again, on the other side, with the vaccine progress, Britain's medical regulator approved the Pfizer coronavirus vaccine, and it's going to be the first country to give the green light to the drug. Britain plans to roll out some 800,000 doses of the vaccine before the end of the year. So we have bad news and we have good news. Linda, I want to start with you. Nearly 37,000 Americans died of COVID-19 in November, the most in any month since the early days of the pandemic. What is the current president, the current administration, doing about it?
That's a really good question. I mean, here's an example. The White House is having a bunch of Christmas parties, as is the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo. The health authorities of the U.S. government are telling people to not have gatherings outside a few immediate family. Stay within your household. Don't have a big Christmas family reunion. And yet the president and other top people in his administration are having parties. They're not wearing masks. It's just a continuation of this president's inability to model proper behavior during a very tragic time, which we're being told as we head into winter is going to be a very dark winter in all ways.
Jonathan, moving to the economic side of this, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell rejected a $908 billion stimulus plan, but he also insists that there must be a plan passed before the end of the new year. Will this stimulus package, this economic package of relief for Americans, happen before the end of the year? And what needs to change to put the tumblers in place to make that occur?
I can't say whether something will pass. Given the seriousness of the crisis, one would think that members of Congress wouldn't want to go home for the Christmas holiday before they've passed some relief measure, because all of this aid that the government has provided so far is going to run out at the end of the year. And a lot of people are going to be in very, very dire economic circumstances. So one would think that given the political pressure that they will do something, and I hope they do. However, the Democrats and Republicans are very, very far apart on the actual number of dollars that they want to appropriate. It began with the Democrats wanting something like $2 trillion and the Republicans offering $500 billion. Now it's the Democrats have come down to $908 billion, so almost a trillion, and the Republicans are sticking with their $500 billion figure. So it's really just a matter of negotiation at this point. But the problem is that there's not a lot of time. These kind of negotiations usually take some time, and the big question mark is whether they can get it done before December 11th, which is when they all leave to go home.
Linda, I'm going to go to you on this one. The vaccines are coming out. Vaccines are being rolled out already, approved and being rolled out in Great Britain. Vaccines are on the horizon in the United States, but not ready yet. And we still have an immediate health crisis that requires mask wearing and social distancing. Every health official has said that. My question is this. The U.S., in my humble estimation, failed in terms of tracking, testing, and PPE production early on and throughout the great majority of this pandemic situation. What needs to change so that it can succeed with the production of the vaccine and the distribution of the vaccine going forward?
What we need is everybody to put their partisan hats off to the side and do what makes sense in terms of logistics, supply chain management, get the best people in there. We're about to have a new administration. I think Joe Biden will put the very best people on this task. It's his top priority coming in. And then they need, on top of that, there are a significant portion of the American public who are anti-vaccination. A lot of them tend to be Trump supporters. They think vaccines cause other problems and aren't willing to do that. We need to reach herd immunity. We need a significant portion of the public to take the vaccine. And I will bring up one happy point, which is that three former US presidents, Barack Obama, George W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, have all offered to take the coronavirus vaccine on camera to promote confidence in its safety. I'm not sure they'll convince everybody, but just having that visual demonstration of three very prominent Americans, I think it can't help but be helpful.
It reminds me of a comment that that official from Georgia made that I mentioned earlier in the show, let those in positions of leadership show it. And I think that's a great display of leadership, sorely needed in these times. I want to take us to the Iran situation. Members of Iran's parliament were chanting death to Israel after meeting to discuss the killing Friday of the country's top nuclear scientist. This from the New York Times. Iran responded Wednesday to this assassination of its top nuclear scientist by enacting a law ordering an immediate ramping up of its enrichment of uranium to levels closer to weapons-grade fuel. And the measure also requires the expulsion of international nuclear inspectors if American sanctions are not lifted by early February, posing a direct challenge to President-elect Joseph R. Biden. Jonathan, you have much experience in this area. Let's talk first about responsibility for the assassination. Is it confirmed that Israel is responsible, and is Israel claiming responsibility?
Israel has not commented at all about this assassination. Apparently, a U.S. official, intelligence official, has said that Israel was responsible, and that's quite logical. Israel has killed about five other Iranian nuclear scientists between the years 2010 and 2012. So this top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was definitely on a list of the Israelis for targeted killing. The question here is about the timing. Some people feel that it was a message to Biden to complicate his desire and efforts to get back into the Iran nuclear deal as soon as he takes office. The Israelis don't like that deal. They never liked it. And they are trying to complicate his diplomacy to get back into that deal. Another explanation is that the Israelis have a list of things that they want to accomplish in terms of hurting Iran and hurting its nuclear program. And they feel that once Biden comes into office with more of an outreach to Iran and less of a hostile approach like the Trump administration has toward Iran, that it would be more difficult for Israel to actually carry out these things. So they want to get this stuff done quickly and within the short time period that they have before Biden takes office.
Lynn, I'll look to you for the last word. Your thoughts on how this particular incident and this situation complicates matters for the incoming foreign policy team in the Biden administration?
Well, I think Jonathan explained it all beautifully. And I will add that the Trump administration has been trying to tie the incoming Biden administration's hands on a number of fronts. And on Iran, they've piled on more sanctions. They just don't want Joe Biden to do a lot of things that he wants to do. And most outgoing administrations want a smooth transition.
Michael, if I could just add one thing. You mentioned the Iranian parliament's passage of this law. It's important to know that the nuclear program in Iran does not come under the jurisdiction of parliament or anybody but the supreme leader. So in a way, this law that they passed is almost the equivalent of a non-binding resolution in our Congress, where you get a sense of the Senate or a sense of the House expressing their feelings about an issue, but the resolution that they pass is not legally binding. That would be the equivalent in this case in Iran.
Well, that's a very important distinction, and thank you for making that. Unfortunately, that is all the time we have. So grateful for your insight and commentary. Thanks so much to our panelists, Linda Feldman, Washington Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor, and Jonathan Broder, Contributing Editor for Congressional Quarterly. This program is produced by the Voice of America, and I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.